Hey, it's Conrad Thompson, and you're listening to 83 Weeks with Eric Bischoff. Eric, what's going on, man? How are you?
Well, I'm doing great. I feel like I'm in the middle of a goddamn forest fire here. I'm just surrounded by salacious fires in California, Utah, Montana, Colorado, and all of this smoke is settling right into Cody, Wyoming. So I woke up this morning feeling like I was out in the middle of the woods in the middle of a forest fire. It was brutal. But other than that, I'm doing great. It's a beautiful Sunday afternoon.
Well, I'm glad you're with us, and hopefully everybody is safe and everybody's doing okay. Man, there's just a lot of weird stuff going on, but nothing weirder than when the Macho Man himself came.
Brother. How's that?
I think everybody has a Macho Man impression, do they not?
My God, it is the easiest impression in the world to do. Anybody could do a Macho Man impression.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think he's the one everybody sort of gravitates to?
Well, I mean, it's an easy impression to do. Easy impression to do. All you got to do is growl.
Right.
Get your lips together, brother, and kind of growl from the dead voice. Kind of drag out your bowels, you know what I mean? It's just an easy one to do.
And man, let's sort of start at the beginning. You know, I mean, I got to tell you, I grew up a huge Macho Man fan. I was introduced to his character at WrestleMania 4. I saw the double tape VHS and I was a wrestling fan right after that. I was hooked in and ready to go. And he was sort of, you know, I guess the number two star in all of wrestling. Tell me about the first time you met Randy and what your perception of him was before you guys actually started working together.
My perception of Randy, I mean, clearly I put him, you know, in that top category in WWF at that time. You referred to him as number two. I think everybody looked at Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage, you know, interchangeably to a degree. Hulk being kind of the icon of the hood ornament of WWF back in the 80s, early 90s. But Randy was right up there. I didn't, you know, before coming to WCW, truth be known, I didn't watch a lot of WWF content. I was certainly aware of them, and I did watch it occasionally. But I, because of, you know, my, I guess my age or the way I grew up as a wrestling fan, I was still kind of – I favored, you know, the AWA. I favored my local promotion more than I did the WWF, and in large part because I was just more familiar with the local characters that I grew up watching in AWA. So I didn't really gravitate, you know, when WWF was really making their move in the mid 80s and late 80s, I didn't like immediately jump on the WWF bandwagon. So truth be told, although I was really aware of Randy, you know, as a wrestling fan, even a peripheral one for WWF, you'd have to be blind not to have been. But I didn't follow him closely. I just knew he was one of the big stars. And I didn't think about him too much until actually about a year before we hired him. And Bob Dew, who was my counterpart, you know, he wasn't my boss, but he and I both reported to Bill Shaw. Bob was in charge of the Omni. He was in charge of arena events. He was in charge of licensing and merchandising, marketing, that type of thing. I was in charge of the television side of the business. But we were both kind of equal. And Bob Dew and myself and Bill Shaw, the three of us, went to an event, a WWF event in Phoenix. Now, Bob and Bill both loved to play golf. They were like, you know, avid golfers. They loved to play golf. I didn't play golf. I drove the cart, mixed the drinks. That was it. But we went to Phoenix so they could play golf, and there was a WWF event there at that particular time. And Bob and I and Bill decided to go check it out because, you know, at that time, WCW live events were just in a fucking tank and nobody could figure it out. It was like this, you know, the holy grail to be able to, you know, draw 2,000 or 3,000 people that would actually buy a ticket. So we thought, well, let's go see how they do it. It was a house show. It wasn't a televised event. So we went, we sat up in the cheap seats, and when Randy came out, and that was the first time I'd seen Randy live. That's the important part of the story. When Randy came out, the crowd just went nuts. And I don't remember who else was on the card, but I do remember Randy, and it was just amazing to me that 6 or 8 months later, you know, I'm talking to him because, you know, Vince McMahon evidently wanted to retire him from the ring and didn't want him to wrestle anymore. So that's a very long-winded first perception of Randy Savage.
So when you're checking Randy out, I mean, at that point, do you sort of have an idea that, hey, this is what I want to do? I mean, did you know right then this is a guy that I wanted, or?
No, no, there was no way I could have, you know, foreseen the future. I didn't know. I couldn't have imagined that he would be available to me, you know, where I was sitting. And again, you have to kind of put it in the right time frame. I want to say context, but I overused that. In the context of when I saw Randy, we had no – there was no plan or aspiration or even wishful thinking that we would be able to bring in a Hulk Hogan or a Randy Savage. We certainly didn't know that Hulk would have been available or that Randy would have come available. You know, all we were trying to do was stop the bleeding at that time. We weren't thinking in any way, shape, or form of talent acquisition, and we wouldn't have known that those guys, you know, 6 or 8 months or a year later would be available.
Before we talk about the actual conversation you have with him, I'm fascinated by the idea of you and Shaw and Bob Dew and everybody going to a house show. How often did you guys do this? Was this a one-off? Did it ever happen again?
It was a one-off. And again, I love Bill Shaw and have a ton of respect for him. He's a really, really good man. And he was a great executive at Turner Broadcasting, one of the best. But I will say, it was a boondoggle. These guys said, hey, let's go. We the three of us need to get together offsite, which is, you know, code for let's get the fuck out of town and go somewhere with a good golf course. And let's go somewhere offsite and really have a skull session and talk about what we want to do with WCW. And just coincidentally, that offsite, and I think it was like in January or December, happened to be at Phoenix at one of the, you know, we happened to stay at the Biltmore, which is a, happens to be on one of the best golf courses in Phoenix. Just all coincidental, I'm sure. I didn't have anything to do with it. I just went along. But the idea was while we're there, let's check out a WWE house show because there's one in town. So it was more coincidental than anything else.
Well, so there you go. Let's talk about the first time you actually have a conversation with Randy. I mean, up until this point, you probably have never spoken to him before you were actually going to do business with him. Is that fair to say?
Oh yeah. No, it's 100% accurate.
So many months later, give me the timeline because I think Hulk Hogan gets the credit for making the introduction. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, and it's funny. You know, we're looking back now 20, 25 years at this point, 23, 24 years. And so much of this stuff, we've talked about this before. You know, when I think back of all the things that I've been involved with, things that I've done, things that have been done to me, things that, that I've been a part of, good, bad, and ugly. You know, over the course of 25 or really for me, going back 30 years, starting in the AWA, all of it kind of just runs together.
Right.
It's like a movie that replays, you know, kind of on a fast forward, but all the scenes are out of sequence because you remember those moments and you remember incidents, but it's sometimes difficult to remember them within a time frame or within the context of other things that were going on. But there's also certain moments that you remember, like, you know, do you remember, you know, I remember where I was standing, and this is going to sound like random and obscure, but I remember when I was a kid, I remember exactly where I was standing when I heard that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And I remember that moment vividly to this day. And there are other moments like that in my life. And I remember exactly where I was when I got a phone call from Hulk Hogan. And it was probably in August or September of 94. I was walking through the airport in Detroit. I was connecting onto another flight. I think I was either coming back from a show or I was on business doing something. But I was in Detroit, and I had like a two-hour layover. And I got a phone call from Hulk. He said, what do you think of Randy Savage? I said, well, he's a hell of a performer. He said, would you want to talk to him? I said, well, sure. He said, here, hold on. I went, whoa, I thought he meant, do you want me to set you up with a phone call or introduce you, or do you want his phone number? Like, hey, brother. I go, whoa, fuck. I wasn't ready for that. But, hey, Randy, how are you? Good to talk to you. And it was a short conversation because neither he nor I know Randy was, you know, if you know, you know of Randy. Did you ever meet Randy Conrad?
No, I did not.
Randy could be, I hate to use the word paranoid because it kind of overstates it, but he was very, very careful, particularly with people that he didn't know or even people that he knew but didn't quite trust. And I don't blame him for that, you know, especially, you know, the wrestling business kind of creates that character trait. But so Randy was very friendly, but I knew, you know, we weren't going to get into a conversation about coming over. It was just, hey, how are you? Good to talk to you. You're in good things, brother. You know, that kind of thing. Letting me know that he'd be interested if I was is really the tone of the conversation.
Sure.
And then Hulk got back on and we talked a little bit and he said, you want to follow this up? I said, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm on my way home. Give him my number. And that's how that started.
So you guys started dialogue and, you know, you've written a lot about this and talked about this a lot before. You know, Savage is saying that he's not very happy with what he's doing and he wasn't ready to sort of hang up the tights and put on a suit. And he hears that that's really the plan. I think McMahon had a meeting with him and said, you know, I'm making a switch. I'm going to the youth movement, which is sort of the same thing he said to Flair a couple of years prior that brought Flair back to WCW. What did Randy express about all of that to you? And I guess we should mention that when Vince tells him this, Randy, I believe, is 42 years old. And I know sometimes people say, oh, well, that's old. AJ Styles is 41. Age is a weird thing. I just wanted to put all that in context. So what did Randy express to you about his situation with McMahon and what he hoped to do differently with you if there was an opportunity?
I mean, he was hot about it. He was very clear that he didn't see himself as a color commentator. He was insulted, quite frankly. And look, Randy was an athlete long before he got into professional wrestling. You know, we talk, you know, sometimes we joke about it. Sometimes we talk in depth about it. But, you know, the one thing that I think everybody that knew, worked with, was anyway associated with Randy would agree upon, if you could only pick one word to describe Randy Savage, what would it be? And I would bet you 80% of the people would agree on intense. He was just such an intense, and with himself, he was competitive with himself. He kept raising the bar for himself in every possible way that he could think of. So when he got the word, and this is the way he articulated it to me. All right. Obviously I wasn't there. I'm not that rumor and innuendo guy. I don't repeat second and third hand shit, but as it was articulated to me, he was pissed off about it. He didn't like being in the booth. He thought he had at least 5 or 10 years left in him. And he believed in himself. He believed that he could still draw major money. And he wasn't shy about saying it. He had a lot of confidence. So he told me that Vince told him that, you know, he's putting him out to pasture. He's going to put him behind the booth. And just snapped, you know, when Randy Savage looked at himself in the mirror at 42 years old, those of us who have passed that mark, you know, realize that, you know, as you get older, your driver's license says you're 42 or you're 52 or in my case, 62. And you know that, yeah, you can add, you can do the math. But when you look in the mirror, you don't feel that, you know, at least I don't. Most people don't, you know, and I'm sure when Randy Savage, giving his intensity and the level of competitiveness that was just part of his DNA, when Randy Savage looked in the mirror at 42 years old and Vince McMahon was telling him he was too old to work, you know, that didn't go over well at all. He was hot about it.
And you were what, a few years younger than him at the time?
This would have been 94. So yeah, I would have been 40 probably.
So you're having a conversation about him wrestling. What does that conversation sound like? Are you guys talking about, you know, the number of dates and, you know, the particulars about the financial end? Or is it more about, you know, what would you do with me, brother?
No, Randy we talked a little bit about this on Patreon yesterday, because I got a couple of really good questions from some of our patrons over there about Randy. And Randy could be really difficult and challenging because he was intense and because he was borderline paranoid, you know, if not probably clinically paranoid in some cases. And that made it really hard until he trusted you. Now, later on in our relationship, I had no problems with Randy. Randy was one of the easiest, you know, major talents there was for me to work with. I mean, we trusted each other completely. He didn't doubt me. But in the beginning, I didn't have that relationship. So it was a little more challenging. But when it came to he didn't have the dates issue. You know, he wanted to know. He was aware, you know, but he knew we were only doing 180 dates a year. You know, at the time he came in, we probably weren't even doing that. Because right. we had cut the guts out of the house show schedule because they were losing money so badly, it didn't make any sense to do any more than, you know, necessary. So, you know, he wasn't concerned about, you know, being on the road 325 days a year. In fact, he probably would have enjoyed that more, quite honestly, at the time. He was like Hulk and others who came in from WWF. You know, they looked at WCW as weak when it came to creative. WCW did not have a reputation for having, you know, a great idea on how to use a lot of people. So he was a little concerned about that, more than a little concerned. And we did talk about that issue. And he was concerned about how he was going to be used. But he also knew that Hulk was there. Hulk and Randy were tight. Hulk was the reason that Randy got his foot in the door. Not that he, you know, if Randy would have called me on his own, he would have got there too.
Sure.
But the fact is, you know, Hulk and Randy had a history, a rocky one sometimes, but they had a history. And at that precise moment, you know, they had a good relationship. And I think Hulk was excited about Randy being there because Hulk knew that that was someone that, you know, he could draw money with. Randy was excited because Randy knew he could draw money with Hulk, or believed he could. So I think Randy coming over knew that he was going to be at the top of the food chain, creatively speaking. Right off the bat. So that wasn't too big of an issue. Most of it was just he wanted assurances that he was going to be featured. He was going to end up the same way he was ending up in WWF, being put out to pasture. I think he was concerned a little bit about the longevity of his deal. He didn't want to come in and just hotshot it and, you know, be shown the door. Those were some of the issues. But honestly, looking back at it, I think it was probably one of the easier deals. In fact, I know it was. For a lot of other reasons, namely Slim Jim. But it was one of the easier deals I've ever put together, his first one.
Well, we'll talk about Slim Jim in a minute, but let's talk about the Hulk Hogan thing, because I think, and you sort of alluded to it there, a lot of fans know that there's been a rocky relationship. And sometimes it was, you know, storyline and they didn't get along on camera, but a lot of times they had issues behind the scenes. Had Hogan expressed any of that to you prior to you having the conversation? And did it come up in your conversation with Macho? Did he need any sort of reassurances about your relationship with Hogan or how that may affect him?
No, I knew, you know, because by the time, you know, Randy made it in, I had gotten to know Hulk pretty well and had spent some time with him, not only working, but, you know, had gone down to Florida and, you know, in an effort to kind of get to know him and build a better relationship with one of our top stars. We got into more social kind of conversations, as opposed to just pure business. And, you know, he would tell me stories. You know, Hulk is a great storyteller. I wish we could get him to do a podcast with us at least once a month, because he's a phenomenal storyteller with great recall when it comes to wrestling events. When it comes to what he did yesterday, forget about it. But when it's wrestling, and he's got a phenomenal recall, much like Bruce Pritchard in a way. But yeah, Randy or Hulk would tell me, you know, about some of the crazy shit, you know, that he and Randy went through. And he walked me through a lot of the ups and the downs and the jealousy with Liz and all of the drama and, you know, Liz and, you know, Terry's ex-wife, Linda. I mean, I heard it all before I met Randy. Ironically, or interestingly, when Randy came in, he didn't have a bad word to say. about it. He didn't imply, he didn't suggest, he didn't show his cards in any way, shape, or form with regard to having any concern about, you know, working with Hulk or their previous relationship. He was a real pro about that.
Is it fair to say that the bulk of the issues between Hogan and Randy in one way or another involved Elizabeth?
You know, I think Elizabeth, again, now this is just me as a fan, right? And I guess a fairly a spectator with good proximity. I think Liz was probably, in some respects, a catalyst for some of the issues. But the issues were really Randy had a desire to be completely in control of his situation. And probably, you know, I didn't hang out with Randy a lot personally. I mean, I went down to his condo. We hung out a couple times and we did some things socially and we took a trip or two together, short ones. But, you know, I got to know him towards the end. I got to know him fairly well socially as a person. But I think from a business point of view, and by the way, before I go on, Randy, I'm just going to speak for myself. When I got to know Randy and he and I kind of passed the threshold of just business and me being the guy running the company and him being a top talent, when we actually kind of passed that threshold and became friends, friendlier, he was a very relaxed guy to be around. When you caught him in his environment, I remember the first time I went down to his, he had a condo. I think it was in Indian Rocks Beach, Florida, if I'm not mistaken. And I went down, and it wasn't about business. I was going to be in town anyway. He was there, and you know, he invited me down. And Randy was a little bit of a recluse. You know, he wasn't a big social animal. You know, Hulk will go out and, you know, he'll walk through Clearwater Beach and he'll be signing autographs on his way to a steakhouse. And, you know, Hulk is like a walking, talking human billboard wherever he goes. Randy was a little bit more reclusive. So when Randy said, "Hey, brother, you're going to be in town. Why don't you swing by? Here's my address." So I did. And like I said, we didn't have any business to talk about. But I remember the first time I walked into his house, there was such a dramatic difference between Randy Savage in his home and Randy Savage in the arena. The Randy Savage in his own home was relaxed. He was chill. You know, he was super friendly. And late, I mean, he was just a completely different person. When he got to the building, you know, when it was business, it's like he had on a coat of psychological armor. You know, I mean, he was just, his eyes were constantly, you know, he's looking around, he's listening to every word, he's trying to read people and trying to read into, you know, what they're saying based on the way they're carrying their body language. And I mean, he was just so intense that way that they were dramatically two different people. And I don't know why I went off on that fucking tangent, but there you go.
So let's talk about, you know, because one of the things he's got to be concerned about is his spot and the way he will be perceived. And he's got to be a little sensitive about getting a little older. And you sort of referenced that you can do the math and you see what your driver's license says, but you know, when you go from 42 to 62, you don't always feel it. So let's talk a little bit about Randy, because he's certainly feeling the difference here, because he's got somebody who's at least allowing him the opportunity to talk about coming in and doing some wrestling. You said it was the easiest deal or one of the easiest deals you put together. You guys discuss a dollar amount and you discuss a number of dates. And how does Slim Jim slide into the conversation?
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
I'm going to get to that in just a second. But again, to kind of put this in the right context, just so people can kind of imagine what that situation was like for me. Randy, I think he made up his mind, you know, with Hulk there, he knew he was going to get a, decent payday. He knew that he was kind of in a dead end situation that he hated in WWF. I think Randy made up his mind pretty early on in the process that he was going to join WCW. There wasn't a lot of dancing involved, if you know what I mean, but sure. in the negotiation, number one. Number two, he had, I don't want to say childlike enthusiasm, but you would have swore this was his first really big opportunity. I mean, the level of excitement and enthusiasm that he brought to just even to the discussions about what's possible, what's not possible, you know, when he was going to start, who he was going to work with. It was not a typical discussion. It was not a typical negotiation. He was so enthusiastic about making the move that it made it fun, to be honest. As far as Slim Jim, Slim Jim had been sponsoring Randy, I believe, in WWF. I mean, Randy brought Slim Jim with him. And while I was negotiating with Randy, I was also negotiating, or I don't want to say negotiating, but I was in discussions with Slim Jim because they wanted to stick with Randy. They loved Randy. They didn't necessarily love WWF. Coincidentally, they were advertising in WWF because of Randy. But what they really loved and were committed to was Randy. Because Randy had spent a lot of time, I believe Slim Jim was based in Greenville, South Carolina, or somewhere, South Carolina, North Carolina. And Randy was spending a lot of time with their marketing people and their promotional people, and he had been for a while. So they loved him. So while I'm negotiating Randy's deal, I'm also discussing / negotiating Slim Jim's relationship with WCW. And the truth is, I think I've talked about this before. It's been published before. The Slim Jim deal was, I don't know if it was 100% of Randy's contract or damn close to it, but Slim Jim basically paid for Randy. It didn't really come out of WCW's budget. There was found money. We didn't have any sponsors at that time, and Slim Jim was willing to spend upwards of $750,000 for the first year for a series of pay-per-view sponsorships, television product placements, and that type of thing. So for WCW, that was found money. It didn't even have to go through Turner Ad Sales. It went right to our books and didn't get filtered through the myriad of, you know, Turner Broadcasting accounting processes where we ended up getting 15% of the money that we actually generated. This money hit our bottom line immediately. So that clearly made the deal even more attractive.
I wanted to circle back now though, to talk about, you know, you mentioned $750,000 from Halloween Havoc. Is that roughly the first year contract value for Savage that you recall?
Yeah.
So when you're having a conversation with him, that's obviously a pay raise. Did he feel like he had been slighted a little bit since obviously WWF was profiting from some of that purchase as well, right? I mean, when some of that money is rolling in for Slim Jim, it's not like it's a direct pass through, which is almost the way you were treating it here, right?
I mean, yes and no. Looking back now, you know, in hindsight, if I was Randy, and this, be careful how I say this. I guess if I was Randy's agent, let's rewind the tape. I'm Joe Blow. I represent the Macho Man, Randy Savage. Randy is a great talent. He brings a lot of name value. His Q factor's high. You know, wrestling fans around the world know who he is, blah, 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 blah. There's a great opportunity with Randy as a key talent here in WCW. And additionally, he's bringing in $750,000 worth of revenue. So as Mr. Savage's representative, Mr. Bischoff, I propose to you, you know, that Randy should be making somewhere around $1 million, $1.2 million. Because that would recognize his talent value and would also recognize a percentage of the incremental revenue that he's bringing to the table that you won't have unless you bring him. And that would have been a good argument. That would have been reasonable. The position Randy took was he liked the number that I gave him, and he didn't look at the Slim Jim money coming to WCW as, well, he should be getting a part of that. A lot of guys would have, but from Randy's perspective, WCW was making a buck. He's making a number that he's very excited about. I'm sure it was a big payday for him, a big raise for him. But more importantly, the money wasn't the most important thing to Randy. This is what made Randy so unique. The money was important. Not going to say it wasn't, but it wasn't the most important. The most important is he was going to get an opportunity. And I think he never said it. He never said anything negative about Vince McMahon or WWF. I mean, he was hot. He disagreed with Vince about, you know, positioning Randy behind the announce booth and, you know, going with the youth movement and all that. He disagreed. He was very vocal and quite articulate about that. But he didn't badmouth anybody. He didn't bury anybody. I think what Randy wanted to do was prove. He wanted to prove to himself. He wanted to prove to WWF and Vince McMahon. He wanted to prove to us that he was still an A player. And he wanted to bring his A game.
Let's talk about his contract that's been released. The contract details, at least the value, 1996, $743,492. This of course was made public after a lawsuit for discrimination, but then a huge jump from 96 to 97, he would bring in over 1.9 million in 1997. Why the astronomical jump here?
Revenues were going up. Business was going up. You know, and I know it's sometimes hard for me, even when I hear these numbers, and I'm sure it's hard for you as a businessman and fans who have never been in the position that we were in to understand. But, you know, when you're bringing people in, and again, Randy was basically free. Let's start out with that. He brought $750,000 to the table with him, and he asked for $750,000. So basically, he was free in terms of an expense for WCW, if just for this discussion, all right? And WCW in 94 was not generating a lot of money. I don't recall what our gross revenues were at the end of 94. I would imagine they were somewhere around 40, 50 million. But by 96, 97, we were probably in the 200 million category, 150 million category. We had become profitable for the first time in the history of WCW in its relationship with Turner Broadcasting. We were in the black in a big way. And talent now wanted a piece of that. And when I say talent, I mean their management, as well as some of the talent. They wanted to share in that. And it's really no different, I guess, than looking at, you know, the rev share model at WWF, although, or WWE, although it's a more, I guess, sophisticated model. But if you go to a house show and the house show loses money, you don't get bonus. But if you go to a house show and you sell it out and you're at the top of the card, you know, you're going to get a big paycheck as a result. And it's kind of the same thing happened here.
So let's talk a little bit about something you wrote in the book. You wrote, "Hurting the WWE wasn't my motivation. I just wanted to make my company better." But you would also continue that, you know, a lot of people didn't always have that opinion. And one of the things that a lot of fans were curious about for all these years is why there was such a lag in the relationship with WWE, maybe Vince McMahon himself and Macho Man, because it feels like he was sort of scrubbed from history for a while, not welcomed right away into the Hall of Fame, certainly not acknowledged until after he passed. And a lot of people have bought into the silly rumor and innuendo of some sort of falling out with Vince over an inappropriate relationship with a member of the McMahon family. When did you hear that silly rumor? And what did you believe to be the situation between Savage and McMahon?
You know, I didn't really hear that rumor until, long after Randy, you know, joined WCW. And again, Randy never buried anybody at WWF, WWE. He never had a bad thing to say. It's almost like, you know, that part of his life, that was his life. And he didn't, unlike a lot of guys who kind of constantly referred back to their time at WWF, and I'm going to be careful how I say this, because sometimes I speak in shorthand and people hear something different than I really want to say. There were people who had worked for WWF and worked for Vince McMahon who would come to WCW. And of course, they would tell me things or relay stories or frame things in such a way as to make me think that they were not only not loyal to WWF, but really wanted to drive a stake through their heart. You know, they would badmouth people. You know, they badmouth Vince McMahon. They badmouth, you know, Kevin Dunn. They badmouth whatever. I mean, I heard that all the time. And I, even though I was young as an executive, I didn't really have that level of experience as an executive. I knew, you know, they're telling me what I wanted to hear, which is not unusual, especially in the wrestling business. It is what it is, right? And I began to filter it out. But for the most part, I didn't really pay close attention to it because I didn't believe half of it. I knew what was going on. Randy was different. Randy didn't do that. Like I said, he never had a negative thing to say. And honestly, the issue between, you know, his past inappropriate relationship or whatever it was, you know, the first time I heard about it, it was more of a passing joke.
Right.
Somebody taking a shot, and the way it was, you know, I don't remember where it was. It was on an airplane, I think, on the way to somewhere. The first time I heard about that, because I remember going, "Whoa, get the hell out of here! It can't possibly be true." But it was positioned as almost a joke, that it wasn't to be taken seriously, a rib, if you will. So it, you know, I took notice of it, but I didn't think about it too much.
You wrote in your book too, Randy Savage and Hulk Hogan always had a bizarre relationship. Hogan originally brought Randy to my attention and really sold him, but I noticed early on there was an undercurrent of hostility between them. They managed it, keeping it out of view and working together, but as time went on, it gradually became more intense. Randy could be intensely jealous and insecure. He was one of the most paranoid people I've ever met in my life. To this day, I haven't met anyone as intensely paranoid. And I liked Randy. We got along. I had no business problems with him either. He was very much a straight shooter. He never played games, and you never had to play games with him. He knew exactly what was coming from him at all times, and I really respected that. But he was always worried about someone being out to get him. Can you give me an example of that, someone being out to get him? Because we hear about the paranoia a lot. It is one of the things that people describe as one of his most prominent character traits. Can you think of a time maybe with booking or another talent that maybe he was a little paranoid? Did he have a situation with, say, a Kevin Sullivan or another talent, a Ric Flair maybe?
Here's what I figured out about Randy early on is the worst possible way to communicate with Randy Savage is through an intermediary. Meaning, if Kevin Sullivan had an idea that he wanted to do creatively. If Kevin gave that to somebody else to tell Randy, an agent, so to speak, or a producer, and that producer went to Randy, bad deal. Because immediately, why didn't he come to me with that, brother? What's he hiding? That kind of thing. You know what I mean? With Randy, if you dealt with it, if you looked him in the eye, this is what I found early on, like the first time I met him. If you kept eye contact with him, the conversation went pretty well. If you allowed yourself to get distracted in the middle of a conversation by looking at your phone or looking around the room, he'd read that. I mean, he had an amazing ability to read people. And sometimes he overread them or misread them. And what would happen with Randy, creatively speaking, what was the catalyst for that, you know, paranoia or get him second guessing and third guessing, is when people didn't deal with him directly, myself included. And I learned, you know, early on, I learned the hard way or the fast way. Just if I needed something from Randy or if I believed in something I wanted to do, just look him in the eye, maintain eye contact. Don't blink. Just keep looking at him as you're talking through it, and it'll be fine. But some people didn't find that as easily with Randy. And I think sometimes Kevin Sullivan probably had issues with him. And look, a lot of people had issues with Ric Flair. You know, Ric Flair was – we've talked about this before, and you know Ric, you know, better than I do at this point. You know, Ric has always loved to be loved by everybody. Ric didn't want to heat with anybody. And sometimes Ric would put himself in a position while he's avoiding heat and not wanting to be put in a bad situation with people that were his peers, which I completely understand. It's why putting a guy like Ric Flair or Kevin Nash, who's, you know, a major talent and a booker, is such a fucking horrible idea. But, you know, that also creates a little distrust because sometimes you're not as honest with the, you know, someone like Randy as you should be about something you want him to do. And the minute he sensed even just a fragment of, doubt or indecisiveness in the way you're presenting something, he would seize upon that and think you're trying to pull something over his eyes. That's why I think, you know, Randy and Diamond Dallas Page, which when I first heard these guys say they wanted to work together, you know, and I heard, you know, them lay out what they – their vision for what they were going to do, I went, well, this is never going to fucking work. Randy's going to shoot Paige. He'll just put a bullet in his head before this thing ever gets to, before it ever gets to the ring. You know, because Paige had a certain type of personality and Randy had a certain type of personality. What I underestimated and didn't realize is these two guys would just bore holes in each other, you know, staring each other down, working on this thing in a positive way. And they got along fantastically because Paige was 100% transparent. And so was Randy. You know, Paige didn't know how not to be transparent. He was obnoxiously transparent. He'd tell you shit you didn't want to know. And Randy liked that. And I think that's one of the reasons they worked together so well.
I guess that's important to mention that when you bring him in, it's coming in on the heels of a Halloween Havoc that was probably a bit of a disappointment. It was Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage. And when the buy rate number comes in, it doesn't exactly meet expectations. How far in advance of the announcement that you guys had worked a deal out with Randy, which would have been early November 94, did you actually start working on it? Because it certainly feels like a lot of the journalists at the time would think that this signing was in reaction to a poor buy rate.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
Judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
No, that's not true. Again, you know, second, third hand, fourth hand information, or at best, and probably what those journalists were writing about is just them sitting in their basement in front of their computer, taking a wild ass guess and just making shit up. It wasn't in a there was never a reaction to a poor buy rate to suggest. I mean, just think, okay. So now you're going to get me fired up. Just all anybody has to do. You could hate my guts. If you're listening to this show and you're a big Dave Meltzer fan and you think all I do is, you know, bury Dave Meltzer, whatever. Have it. Believe whatever the fuck you want to believe. I really don't care. It's not going to change my life. But if you want to just kind of make yourself a little smart for a minute and sit back and go, well, wait a minute. The only reason they signed, according to – I'm assuming it was Dave Meltzer. Could have been somebody else. The only reason that they signed Randy Savage was because of this piss-poor buy rate at Halloween Havoc. Now, if you believe that, or if you wrote that and you believed even a portion of it when you wrote it and published it, you would have to not understand or even be aware of the fact that Randy Savage came with a $750,000 fucking paycheck that he put on the table when he walked in the door.
To be clear, it wasn't written that I mean, he even wrote, Dave, the beginnings of the negotiations with Savage preceded the Hogan Flair match, but it does feel like, hey, maybe they knew they needed another money opponent, because I think one of the silly stipulations here, even at Halloween Havoc, was this was a retirement match and Flair lost, so he's going to go away. And of course that step never stuck, especially in WCW. So of course he's coming back, but I think the thinking is Hogan maybe wanted to go back to what he knew. How much of that do you believe is true, that he drew the best WrestleMania buy rate, you know, in a long time, a huge numbers at WrestleMania 5. It exceeded all expectations, and they never really did a singles rematch in the WWF. They did tag matches at SummerSlam and things like that, but as far as them one-on-one, it hadn't been done in a while. And the last time they did it, it was hugely successful. And Hogan is the guy who puts you on the phone with him. So some of that of Hogan wants to go back to what he knows makes sense, does it not?
I mean, it can if you want it to. I mean, if you want to buy into that theory, and if you want to ascribe, not you, but if a reader or a listener wants to, you know, buy into the theory that the only reason that we brought you know, Randy in was the reaction, the way this was set up, you know, to a poor pay-per-view and feeling like we had to have another big money opponent for Hulk Hogan. And that was it. If you want to believe that, you can. And you'll probably find a way to justify it by referring to, you know, Hogan going back to what he knows, because that's partially true.
Sure.
We all know that. I've talked about that before. Here's the real reason. The real reason is because we saw growth. From the time we signed Hulk Hogan, we were starting to see positive growth. We were shoring up our expenses. We were watching our financials. We saw indicators that led us to believe that if we kept building our roster, and the initial idea when I first came in, you know, to change our brand perception from being the little tiny Southern, you know, Me Too kind of wrestling company who couldn't even get a free drink at a major licensing and merchandising show, or couldn't get anybody at DirecTV to really pick up the phone and take our phone calls because our pay-per-view sucked so bad, or couldn't book an arena anywhere in the country because everybody knew we couldn't draw. The only way we were going to fix those things was by bringing in talent like Hulk Hogan, like Randy Savage. Hulk Hogan worked. Bringing in Hulk Hogan from a business-to-business point of view, not from a Dave Meltzer point of view, okay, not from your average wrestling fan point of view, but from a business-to-business perspective, bringing in Hulk Hogan had a significant impact on WCW's bottom line, and not only the immediate bottom line, but our ability to start talking to people from a business-to-business perspective that we weren't able to talk to. Whether it was improving our pay-per-view positioning, whether it was improving the amount of marketing and support we would get for our pay-per-views, because now all of a sudden our pay-per-view partners believed that with these big names we could start drawing too, so they were willing to risk more money on our product. Those are all of the reasons why when Randy became available, it all made sense for all of those reasons. And certainly having somebody like Hulk or somebody like Randy to work with on the roster with the Hulk Hogan is certainly one of them. But for anybody to suggest that it was a reaction to a poor dissipating pay-per-view buy rate is a reflection of their ignorance.
Let's talk about the way Vince McMahon finds out, because he actually has him advertised for a Madison Square Garden show at the end of November in 94. And he's going to be a special guest referee. And of course that doesn't happen. And he announces in early November on Raw that they couldn't come to terms. And most everybody listening to this has seen that clip before. And then you guys debut him on WCW Saturday Night with an interview with Mean Gene Okerlund. And I think this was done at Center Stage in Atlanta. And it's done in a way where you're trying to build intrigue and interest as to what's going to happen when he finally sees Hulk Hogan. And he teases in this promo that he's going to be at Starrcade and he wants to see Hulk Hogan, but he's not sure if he's going to slap him or shake his hand. And it feels like this is maybe too late in the game to put him into a match. So that's the next best thing, right?
It was, you know, and I watched that interview yesterday on Patreon, did a watch along. And I actually put my iPad on camera. So we literally, you know, with our followers over at Patreon, watched that setup for WCW Saturday Night. And, you know, a couple things that I took away seeing that interview again. One, first and foremost, is that Randy did a phenomenal job building anticipation. It wasn't a match. You know, it was a short window, as you pointed out, but you know, to come into WCW Saturday Night, he got a tremendous crowd reaction and cut what I think was probably about a 3-minute promo, if not longer, that he completely improv'd, by the way. There was no script. That was the other great thing I loved about Randy. And Gene was spectacular as well, Gene Okerlund. But to go out there for 3 or 4 minutes and talk about, you know, meeting Hulk Hogan and am I going to shake your hand, brother. I'm going to reach my hand out or I'm going to slap you in the face and spin your head off your shoulders all the way back to Venice Beach, California. It's a fucking great promo. But it did what it should have done is create the question. This is one of the things to this day, if I was ever in a position again creatively, and I learned, you know, I learned so much, especially during the last 3 or 4 years at WCW and, you know, year or two at TNA about storytelling. And I learned it not so much in WCW, and certainly I didn't learn shit in TNA other than what not to do. But, you know, since about 2003, I have been producing along with, you know, my former partner, Jason Hurry, we've been producing television series, creating them, not just producing them. We would create the idea on paper, you know, reality, unscripted stuff. And we'd create the idea and we'd sell it and we'd produce it for a variety of television networks, whether it's MTV, VH1, CMT, NBC, Discovery, WGN. We probably created and produced 20 different television series for just about every network out there. And what I really learned doing that and kind of marrying it to what I learned in 30 years of wrestling is the storytelling process. And some of it we stumbled into, you know, the NWO is a perfect example. Some of it, you know, we got lucky. Some of it we didn't get so lucky. But the one thing that to this day, I really believe more than anything is if you can get your audience to ask themselves a question. So when you get done with a promo, like we saw, long-winded way, I'm going to get right back around to your question. But when you see a promo like Randy cut with Mean Gene on his debut in WCW on WCW Saturday Night, December 3rd, 1994, you can find it on YouTube. You watch that and then you just ask yourself, what did he accomplish? You know, it's a great promo, a lot of energy, big pop, you know, blah, 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 blah. But what did he really accomplish? What he accomplished is he created doubt. He created anticipation, which is a key element in storytelling. People want to know what's going to happen when. And that's what he did. He could have just as easily come out and said, oh, go in, I'm going to shake your hand and we'll go from there. That would have killed it. Or he could have come out and said, Hulk Hogan, I'm going to smack you right in your head. That would have killed it. But what Randy did so effectively, and it's not even a match, is make people go, holy shit, I'm going to buy this pay-per-view to see what's going to happen when they meet. Because he created doubt. And I just thought that – and again, it's not like we talked about it for 45 minutes or an hour. We didn't have a staff of 15 little 20-year-old acne-faced, snot-nosed writers trying to figure out how to cut a wrestling promo. I mean, this is just Randy going, okay, what are we doing? Okay, we're not going to wrestle. Okay, I'm going to make this good. Boom! That was it. And I thought it was excellent. I encourage everybody to go look at it. It's the way wrestling promos should be cut.
You guys received some sort of legal letter, probably from McDivitt, or certainly on behalf of Titan Sports, a few days prior to Savage appearing on Saturday night, saying that if he appears on TV, it would be considered breach of his implied agreement with Titan since he wasn't under contract. So that's interesting to me. You're not saying that he's in breach of contract, but he's in breach of an implied agreement. When Turner executives hear that phrase, do they just crumple it up and throw it directly in the trash can?
Yeah, that wasn't a big, that was a weak shot. You know, if you're going to fire, you know, Jerry McDivitt and his firm absolutely destroyed Turner Legal in their case with WC, and they shouldn't have. The WCW should have never lost or had to settle with WWF the way that they did, because they just didn't fight. They didn't fight as hard. They didn't deal with the facts the way they should have. And as a result, Jerry McDivitt and his firm crushed Turner Broadcasting in their litigation with WCW. But this salvo was like, it wasn't a shot over the bow. It was like somebody picked up a rock and they found a slingshot and they just thought they'd toss it away and see what would happen.
Let's talk about Starrcade 94. What a show this is. I can't wait for us to cover it sometime. It got 8.4% thumbs up based on the reader poll and the Wrestling Observer. Here is your Starrcade main event, ladies and gentlemen. Hulk Hogan beat Brutus the fucking Barber Beefcake. That's it. There's no one else in the match. It was Hulk Hogan versus the Butcher. And I guess we should mention that after the match, Randy does a run in and shakes hands with the Faces of Fear, which is Kevin Sullivan, the Butcher, and Avalanche. And they all act like they're going to ambush Hogan, but instead he turns on the heels and helps Hogan. And then they shake hands and do the posing routine. Credits. 3/4 star is what it got in the Observer. What'd you think of the way you guys pulled off Starrcade 94, specifically with the introduction of Randy Savage at the end?
It's fucking horrible. I mean, it's just, you can't defend it. You can't justify it. Fortunately, you know, I went to look at that video because you sent it to me the other day and it's no longer available according to the link that you sent me. Now, I know I could probably go to the WWE Network and find it, which I probably will sometime when I'm in the frame of mind for some self-flagellation. But it's fucking horrible. I mean, there's just nothing about it that was good. You can understand, I guess, if I try to pull myself out of it because it's a bad reflection on me, I guess. And I try to forget those things. But you can kind of understand the basic story. Hogan and Savage.
Right.
There for a minute, we thought Savage was going to be against Hogan, but no, he's going to be his partner. And we all know that that would eventually, you know, lead to a split somewhere down the line. It's not a difficult story to figure out. Anybody that's been watching wrestling for more than 20 minutes could do it. But the Dungeon of Doom thing, the whole idea of putting together this ridiculous clusterfuck of misfits that weren't believable, that didn't have an edge, that were all kind of the one thing that brought them together was they were all coming together under the mastermind of, you know, the voodoo child, Kevin Sullivan, you know, to take out Hulk Hogan for a reason nobody really understood. It was so nonsensical and cartoonish that I'm kind of glad the link didn't work. I don't know. I don't know if I'm up for it this weekend.
Well, you guys were anxious to get Randy into the ring. So you debut him on the 6th and 7th of January in Birmingham and Montgomery, Alabama. He's replacing Sting on top because Sting was tired from a long trip from Japan. Meltzer would write, quote, "Sting only got polite applause each night and the matches were pretty dead." Right away, you guys start putting him on the road, and you even start doing lots of house show matches with him, including a television taping. And this era of WCW is sort of fascinating because while business is down, you've got such talent on here. You've got Dustin Rhodes, who of course would become Goldust, Jean Paul Levesque, who of course would be Triple H. You've got Randy Savage wrestling Arn Anderson, and you've got old stars like Dick Slater there. How did Randy fit in early 95 with this roster?
I mean, he fit in well. I'm going to go back to what we started talking about early on in the show. You know, his attitude was so good. And the guys loved Randy. I mean, Randy didn't come, nobody, you know, when Randy came in, there wasn't a lot of guys walking around, you know, with long faces, kind of complaining and pissing and moaning because we're bringing in a WWF guy. Randy had a lot of respect. There was nobody that didn't respect. Randy had, everybody knew Randy had an amazing work ethic. He was smart. You know, he'd been in the business a long time. He came up the hard way. He paid his dues. He'd been to the big show. So there was no resentment or lack of chemistry or goodwill with anybody on the roster. So in terms of fitting in, if that's what you mean, you fit in great.
Let's talk a little bit about Clash of the Champions. That's the first big show, January 25th, 1995. It goes down at Caesar's Palace Sports Pavilion. It's a sellout, and you know, that's only 3,500 in attendance, 2,300 paid, but still, it's a gate in excess of $60,000. So from a gate standpoint, even 60 grand makes it the biggest clash ever. And your main event is Hogan and Savage taking on Kevin Sullivan and the Butcher. And the thing I found interesting about this match is Butcher puts Hogan to sleep with the sleeper, and then Savage drops an elbow on Hogan, not to finish him off, but to wake him up. Hogan pops up and makes a comeback, the reviving elbow. How did Savage feel about this?
I guess pretty good, because he did it.
It's just, it seems like it shits on the finish a little bit, does it not?
It does. It's kind of counterintuitive from a creative point of view. But, what's so interesting now, looking back at some of this crazy shit, which this was one of those moments that I would classify as crazy shit for a lot of reasons. But when one of the fun things for me was, let me back up. I'm going to preface this. And I've said this before. I want to say it again. 94, 95. I was really uncomfortable in the creative process. I knew what I didn't know. Let's put it that way. I tried to surround myself with the best people that I could get my hands on that I believed could have the right answers. And that's not fading the heat. You know, the truth is I knew what I didn't know. I didn't fancy myself as a booker. I was never exposed to the creative process in the AWA at all. Conversely, you know, just in case we have new listeners here, I was not only not exposed to it, I was framed out of it. I mean, I was, there was a no-fly zone for me. If I would try to get anywhere near it, if I would have even asked a question about the creative process or a decision or a storyline, you know, Vern Gagne would have booted me in the ass and shown me the door. So it was an alien world to me in AWA. When I got to WCW, I'd show up on Sunday night. I'd do what I needed to do as an announcer, probably Monday, Tuesday, sometimes on Wednesdays, and I'd get on a plane and I'd leave. I had nothing at all to do with the creative. Now, I was a fan, like a lot of people listening to this, and I had opinions, but I didn't really understand the process. So by the time I got put into the position of executive producer or even as vice president, that whole world of creative was alien to me still, because I had never really been exposed to it. So I would sit and listen and watch some of the people that I put, you know, whether it was Ric Flair, Kevin Sullivan, Dusty Rhodes, certainly Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage, some of the other talents staying. No, I'd listen to these guys lay out matches because I wanted to learn. I knew what I didn't know, and what I didn't know was the detailed process and the psychology of putting things together, right? So this was early in my educational journey, if you will, from a creative point of view. And I would sit and listen to Hulk and Randy. And these two guys were like, they were like gasoline and flamethrowers. They'd start out, and, you know, these conversations would start out. Well, now I'm talking about great ones, okay? Fun ones, all right? Not that the end result always turned out great, but in this case, you'd watch these guys laying these things out, and Hulk would like throw a gallon of gas on the fire, and then Savage would come back with, you know, another flamethrower, and they would just try to over the top each other, and sometimes it would just get out of hand. It would get crazy, and I think that's probably what happened here. Is they just started laying this thing out. They'd get excited, you know, working with each other and visualizing how this is all going to work. And all of a sudden, somebody threw out a wacky-ass idea. You know what, brother? You're going to go to sleep, and I'm going to come off the top rope and drop an elbow on your skull, and you're so tough, you're going to wake up, you're going to kick out. They won't expect that. Well, that's true. But a lot of times, even the guys didn't think through the ramifications of moves like that. And we still see it today. It's not unusual today to see silly shit just like that. That is kind of a finish killer, or just takes things from the believable to the unbelievable, with spots and finishes and things like that. But these guys were, you know, they were vulnerable to that kind of high spot-itis too. You know, they'd get it occasionally.
Let's keep the good creative rolling. February 95 brings a super brawl. We get Savage and Sting here teaming up to take on Avalanche and Big Bubba Rogers. Of course, the baby faces get the win. There's a great promo here that you should go out of your way to search. You can just throw it in your Google machine. Macho Man is not talking. That's a fun promo with Sting and Macho Man here. Macho Man is ruining all the house shows, or almost all of them, especially the really smaller venues. You know, places like Gainesville or Amarillo or Waco. And I guess here at the time, he's got to be having some sort of positive impact on house show business, because Hogan's not working the majority or any of these house shows. So he's sort of the headliner by default. Let's talk about Uncensored March 19th. This is a show I can't wait for us to cover in long form sometime, but on this card, we get Randy Savage getting a win over Avalanche. And interestingly enough, Ric Flair in drag happens here. Wow. Tell me what you remember about the idea to put together, Savage and Flair. Obviously they had a world title match at WrestleMania 8. So fans know about the history, but Ric Flair in drag, who booked this shit?
Ric.
That's so great.
I mean, come on. I mean, you asked the question. He's your future father-in-law.
Chat me up. What'd you think about the decision to put Flair and Savage together? That's a Flair call.
I think it was a Flair call. I think it was, I mean, all of us thought it was a great idea. It's not a tough call. You got two of the biggest names in the business. They have history. They've got legacy with the audience. They know the story. How could you not put them together? Even if it's put them together to split them up, from a storytelling perspective, you had to go with that. Are you kidding me? And you knew, or at least at that point, you know, I believed 100% that you're going to get an amazing product out of it. Are you kidding me? Ric Flair and his ability to not only work magic in the ring, but what he could do with a microphone when he was properly motivated. Randy Savage, same thing. It had all the potential in the world.
Kevin Sullivan has gone on record as saying that Hulk really wanted to have a monster factory, and he wanted guys that he could trust. Is the decision to pair Randy with so many former WWF talents a Hogan's influence, or is it Savage's call? I ask because, like Clash of the Champions, they're in there with the Booker, Kevin Sullivan, and the Butcher, the old Brutus, the fucking Barber Beefcake. Super Brawl, he's in there with Avalanche, the old Earthquake, and the old Big Boss Man. And then even, you know, at Uncensored, he's back in there again with the old Earthquake, and he's going to be feuding now with Ric Flair. Again, someone he knows from the WWF. Is that based on Hogan's influence to appease Savage, or is that just who you had at the time?
And so it's both. Hulk did make, you know, going back to when Hulk, you know, came into WCW, I mean, one of the things, once we got past all the, and I know we're talking about Randy here, but I want to make sure I do a good job answering that question. Once we got, Hulk and I got past all of the niceties and the informal part of the process of negotiating a deal. One of the things that became abundantly clear was that Hulk didn't trust a lot of people in WCW. He knew that he'd have heat. He told me that flat out. We still joke about it to this day. I talked to him last night, as a matter of fact, and we referenced something that was going on, and he said, I told you, brother, you work with me, you're going to get heat. And he knew that he'd have heat coming in, and he didn't want to deal with it. That's why Ric Flair was so instrumental in getting Hulk Hogan into WCW, because Hulk knew that no matter what, he could have a great match and he could trust Ric Flair. And if Ric Flair was booking and he was working with Rick, Hulk felt comfortable. Now, to your question, you know, that concern continued. You know, Hulk, it, based on his past experience, and it's easy to look back now and be critical of it, but, you know, in 94, 95, we're talking only 3 or 4 or 5 years previous, Hulk was tearing down the house with some of the names that you mentioned, not necessarily Brutus, but, you know, he was doing great money with some of those names. So in his mind at that time, in context, he believed that he could do it, or at least do well enough to justify it again. Not only that, from a business point of view, but he did trust those guys. You know, Hulk was, you know, when he got to WCW 94, you know, even with Randy, because of the nature of his personality, they wanted to be in there with guys that would make them look as good as possible, that they could, that they did trust. Not only trust from a an integrity perspective, but trust from a physical perspective, that, you know, it would be a good dance. You don't want to go on Dancing with the Stars with a partner that you're not confident is not going to two-step with you and make you look as good as you could look. And some of those choices that you just mentioned were probably, you know, a result of that.
Let's talk about Slamboree 1995. Here we've got Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage beating Ric Flair and Vader. The match gets a star and 3/4. I feel like we should mention here that we've got Angelo Poffo here involved in the angle. Tell me in the world, how in the world Angelo Poffo winds up on a WCW pay-per-view and there's physicality here. I mean, I think he's like 70.
Randy was pretty insistent upon that. You know, Randy, you know, to the day he died, was so passionately loyal to his family, his mother, his father, and his brother, that when the opportunity came about to interject his dad, it didn't make any sense. It wasn't something I was excited about doing, but it was an accommodation.
So it looks like the newsletters would report after this, quote, the Randy Savage heel turn is now scheduled for the spring of 96. Now, of course, we're not actually going to see that the way we think we will. A heel turn will happen eventually. But at this point, were you guys sort of eyeing Randy Savage and Hulk Hogan at Starcade for 1996, do you think?
Yeah, we were. I mean, that was, you know, bringing Randy in and teaming him up with Hulk, as I said, you know, 40 minutes ago or so, you know, the idea was originally to split them up. That's why you bring two guys in. Am I going to shake his hand? I'm going to slap his face. Well, he shook his hand. Wow, they're friends. Well, eventually you get, if you're going to tell a good story at some point, you know, with that talent, there's going to have to be an element of betrayal. Somebody's going to have to screw somebody. And that was the intent. And that was generally the plan and the arc.
Let's talk about the way the relationship was changing a little bit, because it feels like some of the boys at this point who were there sort of pre-Hogan, pre-Savage, may have been a little upset. Steve Austin has gone on record as saying that he was upset with what he called Hogan cronyism. And he had a meeting with you at Center Stage in May of that year to sort of work through everything. Was Randy Savage discussed there? Because I think you guys had Randy Savage beat him fairly quickly in a match on TV in this era. was Austin sort of a burr in your saddle, or do you feel like he had a valid point and you just sort of had to acquiesce to the bigger star?
It wasn't really as much about acquiescing to the bigger star. I mean, that makes it a personal kind of issue. It was really about recognizing what was happening to the business. On the business side of the equation, all of our indicators were looking up. Things were pointing in the right direction based on the direction that we were going. Even though some of those ideas, some of those matches were horseshit, were bad choices, bad decisions, overall, if you just step back and kind of looked at the macro of what was going on in WCW, purely from a financial point of view, if you worked in Turner Finance, you would go, these guys are doing it right. Saving money, increasing revenue, bigger sponsors, opportunities we've never had before, better positioning. Things are good. So from a wrestler's point of view, from Steve, and I do remember the conversation, by the way. I remember also a small element to that conversation that I'm not sure Steve Austin will remember. And probably the next time he sees me, he's going to kick me in the balls for bringing it up. But I'm going to do it anyway at the end of this. I do remember the conversation. And there was, I don't want to say resentment, because again, that makes it sound personal, but there was an awareness with a lot of talent, talent that was there prior to Randy and Hulk coming in, that things were changing. And guys that were friends of Hogan were being positioned more favorably than some of the guys who weren't friends of Hogan, or were WCW pre-Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage. It was obvious to them. And Steve was one of those guys. And he was, he wasn't in this particular meeting, and it wasn't long. It was like a 5-minute conversation. And I remember it because I think it was one of the last face-to-face conversations that Steve and I had about business. He came to me and he, again, because Steve and I are good friends, and I really, first of all, I respect all of him and I like him a lot. Secondly, I want to try to relay this as accurately as I can. Steve caught me coming out of one of the dressing rooms, and the center stage was really, really small. You know, you got 60 or 80, wrestlers there, whatever it was, 40 or 50 wrestlers. You've got 25 or 30 production people running around. You've got office people running around, and the rooms are all the size of, janitorial closets. So it was a really, really, there was no place to go sit and have a conversation, really. So Steve caught me coming out of one of the smaller dressing rooms and pulled me aside and started to have a conversation about, his role. What's going on with him? And, some of it had to do with, a lot of the guys that we were using that were, as I refer to, friends of Hogan's. But Steve also had a suggestion. Steve, if you don't remember this, I'm sorry. But Steve also said, okay, well, why don't, because he was frustrated. He wanted, he saw what was going on. And look, even though the talent didn't know anything about the business of the wrestling business, they knew about the, their part of it. They knew what was going on in the ring and, crowd reactions and so forth. But they weren't exposed to the business side of the equation the way the rest of us were. But they could still see the handwriting on the wall. The information was getting out. House shows were doing a little bit better. As I said, without beating it to death, all indications were good. And Steve wanted to be a part of that. And that's when he came to me and he said, he had an idea. He wanted to work with Hogan. I said, great. What's your idea? He goes, we find out that I'm his long lost brother. I remember at the time, Steve and Hulk had about the same hair and the same male pattern baldness going on. So that, that was the beginning. It's not, I'm not making light of the idea. It could have,
Hang on. You're being serious right now?
No, I'm not. Yeah. I'm not kidding. No, I'm not kidding. Yes, I'm being serious.
The pitch was Steve Austin could be the long lost brother.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was the now we didn't get, look, it could have been a phenomenal idea. had we sat down and Steve detailed it and laid out an arc, there could have been an amazing story there. I mean, it sounds a little, you know, ridiculous, just the way I'm laying it out to you right now, because there was no depth to it. There was no story to it. There was no beats to it. There was no twists and turns to it. It was just, okay, I got an idea. Here's basically it. I'm Hulk Hogan's long lost brother. So, you know, because we didn't have time to sit down and talk about it. And at least, you know, Steve was offering it up. He wasn't just bitching and moaning, to his credit. He wasn't being a dick. He was looking for a way to integrate himself into that category with Hulk. He wanted to work with Terry. And he only had like 2 minutes to pitch his idea. So as ridiculous as I'm guessing you think that idea sounds, and maybe it was, and maybe he didn't have any depth to it beyond that. I don't know. We never followed up on the conversation. But yeah, his idea was to work with Hulk and try to work himself into that category by being Hulk Hogan's long lost brother. Steve, I'm fucking sorry, bro. I will buy the beer next time. I promise.
Let's get to the Great American Bash. This one gets a 42% thumbs up that year, and Ric Flair takes on Randy Savage here, and Flair gets the win. It's a 4-star match. Great reviews from Dave Meltzer, who even goes so far as to say anyone who says Flair is washed up as a worker can eat it. As a draw, maybe another story. It's been years since Savage has put out like this. Basically, this was everything you would have expected from a match between these two in their primes. What do you remember about this match? We're going to talk about the fallout from it, but this match as it was is still a match that people talk about as one of their best.
It was. And as we discussed a few moments ago, you know, on paper, Randy Savage, Hulk Hogan, how could you not bet on that? How could you not bet on that? Now, even, I guess, more clearly, if you knew Randy Savage and you knew Ric Flair on a personal level and how they, what drove them, you would bet everything you could possibly beg, borrow, or steal on that match. And they over-delivered. They did because of who they are, who they were at that time. Randy had a ton to prove. And so did Rick. You know, Rick had been, you know, Rick was dealing with, and this will be a topic for another show, I'm sure, but man, I remember the first time I ever talked about a retirement match to Ric Flair. I mean, I would have had an easier time trying to talk him out of his former wife. Well, especially at that time.
That would have been pretty easy, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not a good analogy whatsoever. He'd be like, yeah, take her. Cleo, come here. Cleo. Eric wants to talk to you. But Rick, man, you mentioned retirement in front of Rick, especially if it was in a match where he was going to retire. Holy shit.
I guess
he came unglued.
I guess we should mention there, the wife you're referring to is his second wife, Beth, but his nickname for her was Cleopatra. And that nickname was given to her by Arn Anderson. So Cleo is the nickname for Beth. July 17th Observer would write this: Flair, who will remain in the company, but no longer a part of the booking committee. That was a lot of the reason, but don't rule out other factors, including Randy Savage still being upset at the Great American Bash. Not necessarily that he lost via pinfall, but that the loss was done without outside interference, which was the original plan. Can you speak to that? Because you guys do a rematch, at Bash of the Beach 95, which was the outdoor show, and Savage gets a pin there. The theme here, of course, is it's outdoors and it's a lumberjack match. And they sort of teased that Elizabeth was going to be a part of that, but she winds up not being. It's not nearly as well received as the first match. It only gets 2 3/4 stars. And we're just a month out from a 4-star match between the two. Was there sort of some hurt feelings on Randy's side about the finish the first time? And what'd you think of the rematch at Bash at the Beach?
There was none that I was aware of. Randy, and this is, and again, I'm not going to go off on dirt sheet writers, but this is where so much of the false narrative, you know, and I guess, look, here's the good news in the wrestling business. Thank God that wrestling fans are probably more interested in what goes on behind the scenes in the wrestling business than they are, in many cases, what goes on television. Otherwise, you and I wouldn't be doing this podcast.
Right.
We wouldn't be the number probably two rated podcasts, wrestling podcasts in the world right now, if that were the case, right?
True story.
Because our fans, our wrestling fans, and not only are they interested in what goes on behind the scenes, they're interested in what went on behind the scenes 20 fucking years ago. So that's a good thing, and I'm grateful for it. I really am. That being said, sometimes that passion and energy kind of creates a distorted view of the world because it starts, you know, somebody will say something in a chat room or somebody else write something in a dirt sheet or somebody will say something in a bar to one of their friends, whatever. And all of a sudden these stories start emerging about what was going on backstage and who had heat with who and who was upset about a finish that aren't true, that never were true. But they've manifest now in the history and the legacy of some of the top talent in the world. In this case, I will say Randy Savage never had a problem doing a job. Randy's only deal was it had to make sense. And sometimes Randy's idea of sense didn't make any sense. But as you know, we talked about in the finish or in the sequence with Hogan where he dropped an elbow on him and woke him up. That was just his intensity, right? That was just kind of sometimes going over the top of over the top. But if you laid out a good finish, particularly in a match like Flair and Hogan, Randy knew intuitively fans want to see a finish, especially if it's going to lead to something else. Randy didn't have a problem with that. And believe me, if Randy would have had a problem with it, all respect to Rick, there would have been a compromise. Rick would have, by the way, Rick would have wanted a compromise if Randy would have had a problem with it. That would have been Rick's decision to compromise if Randy had a problem with it.
You guys do another clash in early August. This time we've got Hulk Hogan beating Kamala and Savage is doing commentary for this one. And there's a big schmoz at the end. Of course, we're going to see Sullivan and the Zodiac and Shark, eventually Sting and Randy Savage make the return. So it looks like you're building towards some sort of Dungeon of Doom versus the Mega Maniacs, and the partnership with Sting continues. Even on a set of tapings at Center Stage, we see Sting and Savage beat the Blue Bloods, and Sting is dressed up, even wearing the face paint. So he sort of, color coordinates with Savage, and Savage is wearing the face paint as well. So they're sort of going all in here, having tons of tag matches and matches together, whether it's on TV or house shows. What was the relationship like between Sting and Savage?
It was very solid. Very, very solid. First of all, Sting was so easy in that regard. Sting would question because he really wanted to understand. Sometimes we'd come to him with things that made no sense. When I say we, I mean whether it was Ric Flair or Kevin Sullivan or me or anybody else. You know, he'd question you and, you know, he'd kind of curl his forehead would kind of curl up and he'd look at you under, you know, lower his head and kind of look at you underneath his eyelids and kind of go, what the fuck? And he'd never say that, but that was the look he'd have on his face. But once you kind of laid it out to him, he was all in. He's a very gracious and generous performer. He just wanted to make sure he understood. And I think with Randy, Sting understood that he was in there with a guy that, you know, he was elevating himself. You know, it wasn't like he was diluting his character by putting over Randy's, and Randy conversely was putting over Sting's. I mean, how could you not get excited about that? If you're Sting and you've lived in WCW, you've lived in the shadows of WWF, you've been considered a second class citizen, not only by the people you work for, Turner Broadcasting, but by the wrestling fans as well, with the exception of a small, you know, core loyal audience, you know, in the South, you know, TBS audience. So for Sting to have an opportunity to work with somebody on Savage's level that was equally as generous and you know, hoping to elevate you know, themselves and each other simultaneously. How could Sting not be excited about that? And he was.
What was the reaction to Luger coming back? Luger, of course, had been in the WWF, and Savage had obviously worked with him there. A lot of people would say that Luger wasn't the best person to work with, the best coworker. Do you remember having any sort of conversation with Savage or hearing any sort of whispers about Savage and Luger having some sort of iffy relationship at all?
I'll go back to what I said. This is one of the things that I admire about Randy. You know, people ask me about him and what he was like, and there's a lot. First and foremost, I love the way he treated my kids. You know, and that's how I judge people for the most part. It's not how they necessarily, what they do, what they say. Well, I judge them by what they do, but not so much what they say or what my perception of them is, but how they treat people individually. And I watch Randy, and there were times when, you know, down at Disney or at a pay-per-view or on the road, Sturgis, whatever. And my kids were almost always around, you know, in the summertime when they weren't in school. And there were times when I'd be, you know, in a distance, I'd be watching Randy, you know, interacting with my kids, and he wouldn't see me. He didn't know I was, you know, 25 yards away across the room and catering, watching, but I watched how he treated my kids. And he was genuine. He wasn't doing it because they were my kids. He was just genuinely a good human being, and he treated kids well. He treated a lot of people really well. The other thing that I admired about Randy, one of the things, is just, as we talked about a little earlier, his directness. He was just so easy to communicate with. You didn't have to read between any lines. I'm sorry, I need you to help me out. I can't remember the first part of the question.
Just about Luger and Savage. And when he comes, you talked about how he really got along great with Sting. Did that change with Luger, or was it very similar to Sting?
No, and I'll go back to the question. I went off on a tangent about Randy and how he treated my kids and other people. The other thing I really liked about Randy is he didn't badmouth people. If Randy had an issue with somebody, he dealt with it directly. He didn't badmouth people. He didn't bury anybody. Not that he never did to me. I only know what I know in terms of my relationship with Randy. He never had a negative word. He may not have said anything about Luger, and maybe that was Randy's way of dealing with someone that he was uncomfortable with for whatever reason, if indeed he was. But he never, when we brought Lex back to answer your question specifically, he never had a negative thing to say. I would have never guessed that there was heat between them if there was.
Well, I didn't know that there was. I just know he's a rather polarizing figure. Of course, we're mentioning him because Nitro is going to go down at the debut, and that's where we see Luger return. The upfronts, or the press conference, as it were, when you guys are announcing Nitro, Flair's not there. Savage is. There's got to be some sort of licensing strategy, because you've talked a lot about the business of the wrestling business. Given his association with Slim Jim, it's a no-brainer to have Savage represent you at that, is it not?
Of course it is. And I could understand, and I don't know, you know, Rick and I have never talked about this, and maybe you have with him. I don't know. I don't recall Rick taking exception to that.
He didn't care.
But I do know that for me, for Turner Broadcasting, for TNT, Brad Siegel, we had to let people know that we weren't just the same old WCW. No disrespect at all to Ric Flair, to Arn Anderson, to Sting, you know, to whoever was helping to keep WCW even alive during all that time up until Nitro. But the hard, true reality was that we needed to convince advertisers and cable systems that we're the fucking real deal. And Randy and Hulk were, you know, a means to that end.
So let's talk a little bit about, you know, what we're building towards. And I think everybody knows that we're building towards the big World War III discussion. It's our number one requested topic, but on our way there, we're sort of priming the pump a little bit. Halloween Havoc we see Randy Savage pin the Zodiac, which is Brutus the fucking Barber Beefcake, in a minute and 30 seconds. And this happens because Zodiac was subbing for Kamala, who decided to quit the promotion rather than do a job here. And this is notable because a fan hops over the guardrail and referee Randy Anderson tries to hold him back. Savage immediately takes his match outside of the ring to get as far away from this real interaction as he can and keep it off the cameras. The match is a dud. What do you remember about Kamala? I mean, is this true? Kamala refused to lose to the Macho Man, so he just fucking quit?
I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true at all. I think there were other circumstances involved in that. Kamala had travel issues. Kamala was not in great health
right
at the time. There were other extenuating circumstances. The length of his contract wasn't one that he was hoping for. There was no real guarantee in anything for him. I think there were a lot of other things, but you know, not doing a job for Randy Savage is not one of them.
It's also the famous night here, Halloween Havoc 95, which I can't wait for us to talk about, where Hogan loses the belt to the Giant. But we're going to set up, of course, the big show, World War III, 1995. It gets an overwhelming thumbs up, 69.3%. And this is everybody in one match. And I'm sure we'll talk about this in long form some other time. But the result is Randy Savage becomes the World War III winner and the world champion. And it goes down on November 26th in Virginia. Why was the decision made to put Savage over here? Earlier in the night, he has a singles match where Luger beats him, but then he comes back, wins the battle royal, and now he's the champ. And this is talked about a lot because of the Hogan involvement. What do you remember about World War III and the decision to put the belt onto Randy Savage here?
Randy had been with us now for almost 2 years by that point.
Well, it was a year. I mean, he came in November of 94. Oh, so we're one year later.
Okay. So he'd been with us about a year at that point, just under a year. And it was time. I mean, he was a top player. I mean, it shouldn't be talked about too much. Why wouldn't you put a belt on a guy like Randy Savage?
Well, I think the idea is that Hogan wasn't eliminated. And so as a reminder here, what happens is Hogan's dumping a bunch of dudes out like three at a time. And then he's pulled under the bottom rope by the Giant and the camera's on Hogan. Savage, who's not on camera, is dumping gang over. And before anybody really knows what's going on, Savage is announced as the champion. And Meltzer would write, Hogan complained that he never went over the top, but was booed like crazy for doing so. Hogan even went to the crowd, which in an earlier interview booed him out of the building and was chanting Hogan sucks at him so loud they had to turn the crowd noise down during the interview, and asked to tell Savage and the ref that he'd gone under the bottom rope and not over the top rope. And the crowd, for the most part, is reacting by screaming no at him. Of course, Meltzer would put it over, saying the Battle Royal was said to be good live on television, but with three rings, three pictures, three announcing teams, the first 15 minutes feel like we're watching test patterns. And I think a lot of people would agree that as a live event, a spectacle, it's easy. I mean, it's fun, but on TV, it does present a certain set of challenges. But the idea here is it's supposed to be Savage's crowning moment, but instead Hogan saying, I didn't go over the top, brother. What's the thinking here?
Probably trying to build story, laying the foundation for story in the future. Be my guess. You know, I'd have to ask him, honestly.
Sure.
I certainly didn't pick his brains when it was over with. But, you know, hearing it laid out the way you're laying it out, knowing Hulk the way I know I'm now, knew him then, it's probably one of those improvisational things he did to kind of at least lay the seed or lay the foundation for something in the future so that it could go somewhere.
The show goes off the air with these two guys celebrating because, as Bruce would tell us, Hogan must pose. So there you go. It's Hogan's or Savage's rather first year in WCW. We talked a lot about the contract and the way it was signed and immediately putting him into, you know, comfortable matches with old opponents, his big feud. They got a 4-star match with Ric Flair. And then a rather interesting finish. And I'm sure we'll cover that pay-per-view some other time. Let's take some questions. We asked you on Twitter at 83 weeks if you wanted to ask Eric a question, and we're going to rapid fire some of these. Eric, are you ready?
Ready.
Josh Kuhn wants to know, where does Macho Man rank all time in Eric Bischoff's opinion?
One of the top three.
Rusty wants to know, did Savage and Liz ever appear as if they would rekindle their romance?
No, they never did. And I'm, you know, it's interesting. We didn't really cover that much in the show, and I'm going to take the opportunity to do it now. Randy was a big advocate to bring Liz in. And, you know, going back to some of your early questions about, you know, my perception of Randy and concerns I may have had about Randy based on what I had heard earlier. At this point, you know, when Randy wanted to bring Liz in, I was a little nervous about it because the history, you know, bringing in your ex-wife, you know, knowing that Randy had a reputation for being insanely jealous and overprotective, probably the better way to say it, really, I really questioned my judgment in making that decision. But I will say that Randy was 100% professional, and he was very protective of Liz. He was creatively, you know, he didn't demand that she be treated like a queen or special or anything like that. But he always kept an eye out for Liz. He was always wanted to be in the loop on what she was doing creatively because he still loved her. You know, he didn't love her in the same way as he did when they were married. But I think the relationship between Randy and Liz was still very strong for both of them. But when we brought Liz in, it was a completely 100% professional, didn't create any issues. And that's not an easy thing to do, especially in a wrestling environment, especially with your ex-wife, especially given, you know, the nature of their relationship and all the things that they had been through.
Jill wants to know, was it awkward with Savage and Elizabeth working together? And I don't mean necessarily for them, but for everyone else.
Not really. And again, just following up what I just said, Randy was so professional, and so was Liz, by the way, that, you know, everybody knew, you know, everybody, you know, especially in the beginning, I think it's fair to say people were probably cautious and a little concerned that the old Randy would, you know, reveal himself and, you know, kind of go over the top, being overprotective and all of that. But again, because he was so professional and so was she, you know, she was married, I think, at the time. She was either married or engaged to a guy down in Miami when I hired her. So that relationship romantically was clearly over, and Randy handled it professionally. So I think after, you know, Liz was in for 2 or 3 weeks, everybody realized that, you know, the crazy Randy, you know, overprotective, jealous Randy of the past he's not here anymore. And everybody just accepted her for her and didn't think too much about it anymore.
Austin has a great question. What's the biggest lesson you learned, business or personal, from the Macho Man?
Intensity is a very good thing. And sometimes people think perhaps you're too intense or you're too passionate to the point of being almost obnoxious. But that's not true. I don't think there should ever be any limit on your intensity or your passion for something that you believe in. And that to me is probably embodies or personifies Randy Savage more than anything else I can say.
Here's a fun question. And this one comes to us from Jeremy. If Hogan was the highest paid, was Savage number two?
I don't think so. You know, I'd have to go back and try to dig up some information. I certainly don't recall everybody's salaries off the top of my freaking head. And I know there's going to be listeners out there that are going to give me the, I don't recall bullshit, but I would say Randy, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, Bill Goldberg. I would say probably Bill Goldberg was number two.
No, we're talking about 95. So let me circle back.
95.
He's gotta be right. I mean, it's gotta be him or Sting.
No, Sting was at 750. I believe.
Where was Flair? Flair's in the neighborhood, right?
Flair's in the neighborhood, maybe just under. So I think Sting and and Randy were probably neck and neck.
Yeah, that makes sense. This is a question we got a lot. Why not have a Macho Man debut similar to the way Hulk Hogan was debuted? There was a bigger reception for Hulk Hogan. I mean, a literal ticker tape parade. This comes to us from Tom. Why not a bigger one here for Macho Man?
You know, in fairness, there probably should have been. It was probably a mistake not to. We probably left a little bit of equity on the table, or in the locker room, I should say, backstage, by not doing that, especially debuting him in WCW, you know, in a small, you know, center stage where there's maybe 350 people. And again, I watched that yesterday, and we made it look as good as you could possibly make it look. Actually, it looked pretty great, even by today's standards, for such a small arena, particularly one configured the way that one was, with such a steep seating configuration and all that. But had we, you know, brought him out with a little bit more pomp and circumstance, no pun intended, with deference to his music, I think we probably could have gotten a little bit more equity out of it. If not from the wrestling audience, because the wrestling audience didn't need it, but I think we probably could have done a better job, in fairness, by positioning him even more so to advertisers and cable, you know, outlets and pay-per-view companies and things like that. It's a good point.
Matt De La Rosa wants to know, Savage was known for his work outside of the ring with children and other charities. Did this continue during his time with WCW?
Yeah, he did. And Randy did a lot of things that we didn't know about. Randy was a good dude, man. He wasn't just doing it for the PR. He was a good dude.
Andrew wants to know, Lanny's deal, what's up with that? And of course, what Andrew's referencing is Lanny Poffo famously had a deal for a long time with WCW. Was that addressed in 95 when he first came over, or did Lanny's deal come later?
Lanny's deal came later. And, you know, I like Lanny. I see Lanny 4 or 5 times a year when we do independent shows and comic cons and things like that. And I didn't really know Lanny. I knew of him, but I didn't know him before we brought him in. But going back to Randy's loyalty and commitment to family, when we renegotiated Randy's, not renegotiated, but when we negotiated Randy's second contract, Randy wanted Lanny to come in, thinking about $1.50 or $1.75. And I just couldn't do it. I couldn't justify it. And we went back and forth, and it wasn't, you know, it didn't get ugly. There were no threats made. There was none of that, but it was Randy Savage intense. And I finally, I said, Randy, I can't, there's just, I can't do that. So Randy said, okay, we've already agreed on my number. Reduce my number by X amount to cover Lanny's. So Randy paid Lanny's deal.
Wow. There you go. Dropping some knowledge here today. Good question. Another question here from Matt. He's bringing the noise here. Poffo was inducted into the WCW Hall of Fame this year. Why did the WCW Hall of Fame seem to die on the vine after this? He's referencing 1995. So you only did it a couple of years here and then it's gone. Why did you pack it up?
I think one of the biggest challenges that we had, probably the core reason, was we didn't have, you know, if you look at some of the last Hall of Fames that we did, we were digging pretty deep, trying to find people, you know, that would come in and be a part of that. We were relying upon people that had no real direct relationship with WCW. And I know the WWE can do that. You know, they get away with the same thing now because they're WWE and they're bigger and, you know, they bought up a lot of territory. So whether, you know, they can induct somebody like Sting, even though Sting never really worked for WWE, they can induct them because now they own the WCW library and all that kind of shit. Well, we couldn't get away with that. So after the first couple of years, we're sitting around the room going, okay, who are we going to induct to the Hall of Fame? Well, the only people that would do it or made any kind of sense were people that nobody else knew for the most part. So the bench of, you know, Hall of Famers that we could attract was already getting pretty thin. I don't think there was anybody that was really behind the idea, myself included, enough to sustain it when it hit those types of challenges. So it was easier to just let it go away than it was to try to fix it.
Talk to me a little bit about, and we get this a lot, kick smart, my heart. Can you clear up the rumor and innuendo that Flair wouldn't job to Macho Man and drop the title, which ultimately cost him his job as the booker? There's this conspiracy theory that Flair had a problem doing a job and feels like he's lost. I mean, that's the way you become 16 time world champion. You lose it a lot, but allegedly he didn't want to lose the belt. And that's the reason he lost his job. That makes no sense to me. What say you?
None whatsoever. Anybody that's worked with Rick, even if you've only been in the building while Rick was working, I'm talking about backstage. Nobody that was remotely close to Rick would ever accuse him of not wanting to do a job. That's the most ridiculous. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Now, there was a lot of other stuff going on. We've talked about this ad nauseum. The pressure of being a top talent and the booker is ridiculous for the strongest, most insanely, intensely well-grounded person that you could imagine. It's unbearable. And for a guy like Rick, who is a very emotional guy, he just loves to be loved. He doesn't like confrontations necessarily from a business perspective. To be in that position was just more than he could bear. That had everything to do with him not being the booker anymore, not doing a job.
Last one, then we'll get out of here. Hoboken Squat Cobbler, what a name that is, wants to know, was there ever any thought to having Randy get a win over Hogan clean just once?
I'm sorry, I was choking on that handle. Could you please give me that one more time?
Lots of people want to know why Randy didn't get just one clean win over Hulk Hogan.
Oh, I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. It's not like Hogan didn't do jobs.
I guess the point is it wasn't a point of contention. You know, we'll talk about it later, but a lot of people say that Hogan pushed for Warrior to come back because it was a way for him to get his win back. And maybe that, and I we'll talk about that later, cause I know you want to rant on that, but we'll hold it for that Warrior show. That sort of thinking didn't exist for Macho Man. Fair to say?
I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, so Hogan beat Savage at WrestleMania 5.
Right.
And it was a huge deal. One of the biggest pay-per-views of all time. There's never really a clean win where Savage beats Hogan after that in a singles match without some sort of crazy shenanigans.
Okay.
That's it.
And the question is why? Why did that happen? You know, I don't know. I can't put myself in Hulk's head or certainly can't put myself in Randy's head at that time. I don't know that if it was.
Point was, I don't know that Macho really cared.
Like, I don't think, I mean, if I had to guess, and that's what I have to do. I mean, we don't have any other choice but to guess, trying to answer a question like that. My guess is, if there's a logical answer for it, it would be that they both recognized. That's the one thing about guys like Randy and I know this for a fact because I used to hang with both of them at the same time when they were getting along. They both knew that they could probably extend their careers, you know, 5 or 10 years just based on their ability to continue to tell stories. So if my guess is that if I had to, they probably realize, okay, there's a big one here where Randy actually beats Hulk clean. And then there's a return, because that's the way they thought. That's just the way their brains work. That's the way they grew up in the business. And that was, to them, that was money in the bank. That would be my guess. My other guess would be, who give a fuck? It's just business. Wasn't necessary. It may have felt necessary to the audience into the conspiracy theorists that are out there, especially the ones that want to, you know, portray Hulk as being really selfish and always protecting himself and, you know, bringing in warriors who didn't have to do a job for Randy, whatever the fucking conspiracy is. Yeah, that makes sense to people that live in that conspiracy world. But I would say my first guess, Randy didn't really care. My second guess, maybe they thought about it and talked about it and realized that that could be money in the bank down the road. I don't know.
We'll see you next week right here on 83 Weeks with Eric Bischoff.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, you know, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat, because that should be your next correction, Richie, is that is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah.
Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.